It's my pleasure to introduce Anjan Chatterjee to you. Anjan is a colleague of mine in the Spatial Intelligence and Learning Center. Anjan received his bachelor's from Haverford in philosophy and his MD from the University of Pennsylvania. After rising to associate professor of neurology at the University of Alabama, he moved back to the University of Pennsylvania, where he is now professor of neurology. Anjan's broad research interests in cognitive neurology include attention, vision, and understanding how humans process events in space. But they also include an interest in aesthetics and ethics. He's been an active participant in the development of the fields of neuroaesthetics and neuroethics. Indeed, he's recently co-edited a forthcoming book on this topic. Anjan is the very model of a research practitioner. He draws inspiration for his research from his patients and also thinks about how his research will change the practice of medicine and more broadly, how the field may change the practice of medicine. He writes about the responsibility of researchers to the health community to guide the practice of how to make decisions as new technology and medicines become available. Anjan won the Norman Gershwind Prize in Behavioral and Cognitive Neurology from the American Academy of Neurology. He has been listed as one of the best doctors in America and is a fellow of the American Academy of Neurology. Please welcome Anjan Chatterjee, who will be presenting his talk entitled Space, Time, and Causality, Some Neural Observations.
Well, thank you very much. It's an enormous honor to be here and to talk at this meeting. It's the whole program sounds terrific, and I'm very excited to be giving this talk. Neuroscientists in general and physicians in particular are probably not known for their modesty. And in keeping with that tradition, I thought I would give this talk with these big words like space, time, and causality. And much to my chagrin, last night, Deirdre Gentner suggested that I wasn't ambitious enough and that I should somehow include consciousness in the talk. And so my goal is to work in consciousness as well. So if you look at least in neurology and cognitive neuroscience in general, when people have asked questions about meaning and how we understand the world, there's been a focus on how we understand objects, how we name objects, how we recognize things. And this can be traced back to the end of the 19th century when people like Broca and Wernicke and Lichtheim and Lissauer were really carving out basic ideas of how the brain organizes our mind, and those ideas have still remained quite relevant, but again, there is very much of a focus on objects. And when you bring this into the modern era, in neuroscience, there's been something similar. If you think about visual neuroscience, people focus on how we understand contrast, how we understand lines, how we might apprehend depth from different kinds of cues in the environment. And also, one of the major findings probably in the last 15 years of neuroscience has been the way in which parts of ventral occipital cortex carves out the visual world into different kinds of entities. So we know a fair amount about how faces are processed. We know something about visual word form areas. We know something about how objects are processed, how buildings and environments might be different, and how human bodies are processed. And this as a strategy has been quite effective in advancing our understanding of how we understand various aspects of the world. However, as part of this divide and conquer strategy, it seems as though something is missing. And when we think about these objects as shown here, what you get is very different than what you get with this kind of image. And when we apprehend things in the world, this is far more typical of how we see things. And the way we understand the world, I would suggest, as others in this audience have, is that this is based on a set of relations, and that objects don't exist in isolation in the world, but they exist in the context of a set of relations. And so what I would like to talk about a little bit is how these relations bind different objects, and how we understand this network of connections of things in the world, particularly in the context of locative information, thematic information, and this sort of leads into notions of space, time, and causality. So the starting point, this is something that is a basic tenet in visual neuroscience right now, is that the visual information, as it moves through the occipital cortex into both temporal and parietal cortices, broadly is broken down into what has been referred to by Ungerleiter and Mishkin as the what stream and the where stream. And I'm quite sure almost everybody in this audience is well aware of this. This was an observation that was originally made using single-cell recordings in macaque monkeys. It turns out clinically this bears out quite consistently. People that have disorders of their ability to recognize objects or to know what objects are tend to have damage to the ventral visual cortex. People that have a variety of kinds of spatial disorders tend to have damage to the parietal cortex. So these kinds of observations that you see from neurophysiology in the macaque monkey generally converge with what we've known for about 150 years in neurology. So the first study that I'm going to talk about is part of an fMRI study, which is basically asking this question: can we use fMRI to make this point that when we are focusing on the identity of objects versus their spatial relationships, do we see this kind of ventral dorsal distinction? And this is a study. Prin Amorapant was the lead author on this. It was an fMRI study in which people are sitting in the scanner, lying in the scanner, looking at these kinds of images. The images across the different conditions are identical, so there is nothing about the sensory properties of these images that could account for differences. And in one instance, they're making a judgment of whether the image they're looking at in fact has the same spatial relationship, the two images, as the previous slide that they saw, or whether they have whether they're the same objects. So there's an identity judgment and a spatial, a locative judgment. And what we find in some ways is would not be so surprising. It would be surprising if we didn't get this finding, which is that when we look at particularly parts of parietal cortex, both the infraparietal lobule and the superior parietal lobule, we have more activity when more neuronal activity or blood flow as a proxy for neuronal activity for when people are making judgments of spatial location of these same objects than when they're making judgments of the object identity itself. It also, interestingly, turns out that there is also more activity in parts of the frontal cortex, and what looks like rather specific parts of the frontal cortex, which is very close to where the frontal eye fields are. And this raises some interesting questions, which we've not pursued, but let me just bring them up with the idea that maybe something about our apprehension of space is integrally tied to the way our eyes move. And again, there are some observations that physiologic observations or behavioral observations that sort of fit with this idea. If you hold your head and your eyes very still and just look at a flat surface, in a matter of several seconds, usually under 30 seconds, your entire visual field will dampen and you won't really see much. And this turns out to be something that a physiologist in the early part of the 19th century, somebody named Troxler, had described. It's referred to as the Troxler effect. And this is true for all of us. It turns out that in our eyeballs, in the retina, our retinal vessels impede light as it's coming in through the lens of our eyes onto the retina. And yet none of us are aware of this. We should be seeing our own blood vessels in the eye all the time, but we don't, and we don't because the retina is habituated, because there is no movement on the retina. And if you want to do a parlor trick, you can go into a dark closet, take a little pen light, and start wiggling it under your eye so you get little shifts in the shadow of your retina, and you'll be able to see your own blood vessels. But nonetheless, the point being here is that one way in which we apprehend space and are able to see different parts of space is integrally tied to these microsaccades and macrosaccades that our eyes do. And so there might be a way in which eye movements are tied in addition to these kind of static locations that the parietal cortex is probably doing. Okay. So this, again, going back to these empirical findings, are pretty consistent with what one would expect. And as I said, if you didn't find this, you'd probably be more inclined to think there was something wrong with the experiment than believing your data. But another part of the dorsal stream, as traditionally conceived, is motion, visual motion. And so here we have a setting in which things are changing dynamically. And the question is, how does visual motion play into this notion of location versus notions of objects? And is there a way we can think about motion in something that is a little more interesting than how we typically examine motion, which is looking at dots moving around or circles coming in and out? Is there a way we can think about motion that is cognitively more interesting? And for this, I would turn to some of the work many years ago now that Len Talmy did, which is arguing that our cognitive systems, as expressed in language, really recognizes two different kinds of motion, that there is a manner of motion and a path of motion. And the manner of motion, one can think of this as having to do with how different parts of a body move in relation to itself. It's a kind of intrinsic notion of motion. And there's a path of motion where you can think of how an object moves with respect to its environment, an extrinsic notion of motion. So, and the observation is basically that language systems across the world respect this distinction between path and manner and express them in different constituents of language. And while the constituents might be different across languages, so for example, in English, manner of motion is primarily conveyed through verbs and paths of motion through prepositional phrases. The question for us was, is this observation about language somehow telling us something about the way our visual system carves out this this visual property? And so for this, we did an experiment where we looked, again, an fMRI experiment. And I apologize for the quality of this video. There's something about transferring it into PowerPoint that does this. I'm not sure exactly why. However, these are stimuli that were adapted from Kathy Hirsch-Pasek and Roberta Golenkoff, developmental psychologists, to try to understand or try to test the hypothesis that our visual system respects this distinction between manner and path of motion. And just to describe what you're going to see is this little starfish cartoon is going to move across the frame with a specific path and a specific manner of motion. Okay, and then here's another example. And then we have another condition where the little starfish doesn't actually move but has a different color. We assume this as a proxy for a different identity. And so the experiment is that subjects are lying in the scanner looking at these little videos. The videos, again, are identical across different runs, and people have to judge whether the second video is the same path or the same manner as the video that they just saw. And what do we find? What we find is that there does seem to be a segregation of how our brain responds to these different kinds of motion. What's being depicted on the top is that every place where there is some color in the image is where there is more neural activity for any kind of movement as compared to the static image. And within that, where I'm not sure how well you can see it, but there are some green voxels, which is where there's greater activity for manner of motion, and there's some orange voxels where there's greater activity for path motion. And it turns out this path, these areas that are specific to path, also involve dorsal parietal cortex, and this area in the posterior part of middle frontal gyrus, which is where most people think is the part of the frontal cortex that guides eye movements. So again, we have this for path, the kind of locative information it is, the dynamic locative information that the brain is responding to has a very similar kind of organization than we do for static locative information. But when we get to manner, what we have is areas that are pushed down more ventrally into parts of the posterior middle temporal gyrus, really where the temporal lobe and the occipital lobe come together. And so once again, there is this notion that our brain has a kind of ventral to dorsal organization in which manner tends to be organized more ventrally and path information is organized more dorsally. Now, of course, manner, as mentioned in English, is often tied to actions as well as to verbs. And so the next experiment is going to be looking at that a little more directly. And what we did was we had people look at these pictures of different actions where they had to make a judgment of which action was more closely associated with the one on the top. This also kind of drafts off of a clinical test that is sometimes used when people study semantics in clinical populations called the pyramid and palm trees task. But this is an adaptation of that, looking at actions as well as looking at objects, and we have a kind of scrambled baseline. And we also have them looking at words referring to these actions as well as words referring to these objects. And what we find, and what's being shown here are two examples of individual patients, individual subjects, that most of our participants are not patients when they're in the scanner. So what's being shown here on the left is one person's time series response of their imaging when they are looking at pictures of actions. And what I would point out is that in the area MTMST, so this is an area that specializes in visual motion that we independently identify in these subjects. In that area, there is greater activity when people are making these judgments for actions as compared to making judgments for objects. And close to that, just a little anterior and dorsal to that in parts of posterior middle temporal gyrus, there's also greater activity for actions as compared to objects. And it's worth pointing out that these are static images now. So as you saw, they're pictures that are not moving. And yet, in that context, we find that early parts of visual cortex that are specialized in motion are being activated in the context of people thinking about these actions. And so one might think of this as rather good evidence for certain versions of embodied cognition. However, when we come to words, something slightly different is happening, which is that it's close but not exactly the same. And what we find is that area MTMST, which is specific for visual motion, is not activated by words, but the area abutting it is. And to show this in a little more visually friendly way, this is what we end up seeing across these studies, and we've replicated this in a different study, which I won't talk about. So in the very bottom, you see where area MT-MST localizes in human participants. When people are looking at pictures, you get this pattern of activity where there's greater activity on the right than on the left, but it is coextensive with where area MT-MST is. And then when you think about words, the activity is primarily shifted towards the left, and it does not activate area MT-MST, but just an area close to it. And this in some ways raises certain questions, at least about the strictest version of embodied cognition, which is, why are words not activating the same area as pictures? Remember, with our contrasts, anything about the specific nature of the stimuli should be subtracted out because of the way this was done, and at least suggest that when we are thinking about actions in the context of pictures and we're thinking about actions in the context of words, there is a different pattern of neural activity, and it remains an open question about what is it about that difference that accounts for the slight differences in neural activity. Okay, so when we think about actions and locations in general, one of the advantages that comes with this is that it shifts your cognitive focus away from objects, and in some ways that this allows for somewhat more abstract thinking because you're no longer necessarily tied in an obligatory fashion to objects. So you can look at these and have a sense that that people are skating, but in some ways the identity of the people doesn't seem to matter very much. You have some sense of what the action actually is over here. So we asked the question, since the way these data seem to be playing out is that when people are thinking about actions, that parts of the posterior temporal cortex seems to be important for this. This is also where manners of motion seem to be localized. Is it the case, or is there any evidence, that this part of our brain extracts actions as distinct from the actors actually doing this action? So is there evidence that we are actually abstracting actions away from the actors? And to look at this, what we did was used a slightly different technique, fMRI technique, that's been referred to as repetition suppression or adaptation. And the general idea here, the strategy is that the brain responds in a certain way, which is that if a part of the brain is specialized in processing X and it sees X again, that part of the brain responds less vigorously. Okay, so it's you can think of it as the equivalent, or at least analogous to priming that you find in behavioral studies. It's almost as though this particular part of cortex is now primed for that stimuli and analogous to responding more quickly in an RT experiment, that there's less physiologic response there. So the experiment is that people, again, lying in the scanner, seeing little video clips of very simple everyday actions. And just to give you a sense of this, so this is just walking. I see different people. People have different shapes, different colors, different forms. People walk slightly differently, but again, there's this family of behaviors where we all recognize this as walking. There are a different family of behaviors that are somewhat similar, but we recognize this as distinct, which is skipping, for example. And as you will see, the individual differences show up a little more prominently when you get to skipping. And then you don't need to have translational motion. So this is where it's pointing. And then again, a similar but not identical motion, which would be punching. looking at these, you can kind of get a sense of who's done what in their life, who the bruisers are. So. All right, so here's the setup, which is that there are you have essentially a 2x2 design, which is that there's an old action, an old actor, new action, new actor, new action, old actor. Old actor, new action. I can't remember which, but I think you get the sense of this. And the critical part of the experiment is what's depicted in green here. Yeah, so this right there, because in those instances, the actual videos that people are looking at are completely novel. So they haven't actually seen these videos before, but they have seen the actions before, The question is whether in parts of the brain in the posterior parietal cortex, is there more selective adaptation to these kinds of images in areas that we hypothesize might be important. And so in this experiment, we also, independently of these runs, localized different areas of the brain. So we localized area MTMST, which again does visual motion. We localized an area in posterior superior temporal sulcus that seems to be specialized for biologic motion. We localized an area that Paul Dowling and Nancy Kanwisher had identified as being specific to bodies, human bodies, which they dubbed the extrastriate body area. And those three areas we thought might have something to do with our ability to understand actions. And then we also identified areas within the fusiform gyrus that is specific to faces, areas within the parahippocampus, which my colleague Russell Epstein, among others, identified as being important for places and buildings, and a general area that sometimes is referred to as the lateral occipital complex that is specific or tends to respond to objects in general. And what we find, and again here the green bars are the most relevant for this discussion, is that within posterior superior temporal sulcus area MT and the extrastriate body area, there is less neural activity to actions that people have seen before, despite the fact that the videos themselves and the people doing the actions are novel, and not in these other areas. So this is not a general effect. It's not a non-specific effect, but seems to be rather specific to these areas that we think that has something to do with human bodies and something to do with movement, something to do with biologic motion. And at least our take on this is that that this is probably parts of the brain along the lateral aspect of the temporal cortex that allows us to extract and abstract actions as distinct from the actors actually doing these actions. So what I'm going to talk about next are a couple of studies that were done with a series of patients with focal brain damage, and the history, this could easily be a different talk, which is what's the history of lesion analyses, how have we progressed from the time of Paul Broca, who essentially what he did was he had to wait for someone to die, get an autopsy, you get the brain out, and part of the original case that Broca described, the way he identified the lesion was basically sticking a probe in where the hole was in the brain and trying to infer how much was damaged underneath that. Well, we've come some way from that as our method, and more recently there have been interesting statistical methods that have been transferred over from functional imaging research to these kinds of lesion analyses. So for this experiment ends up being related to what I've been talking about, we chose to look at patients with left brain damage, and these are patients that have had their damage at least 6 months out, so they're relatively chronic patients that have a variety of language problems, and we were particularly interested in how they did on this kind of task, which is where they have to match a picture to images. In one instance, the picture is a locative kind of statement. The circle is above the square. The other is one that has to do with actions and the thematic roles embedded within these actions. The circle pushes the square. Now, it turns out in the 80s, in the late 80s, both Myrna Schwartz and Eleanor Safran, along with Oscar Marin, had first reported that patients that were aphasic tended to have trouble with these kinds of tasks. And what is quite a robust finding when you look at these patients is that, in general, people tend to do much worse with passive constructions than with active constructions. And this got a lot of people excited and got people focused on what might be happening there and whether these kinds of patients could be used as probes and evidence for various hypotheses that people had about how passives are constructed and how you do these kinds of transformations of sentences, and could this be a probe for a biologic probe for those kinds of linguistic observations? But in the process of all of that, there was a very basic thing that was not picked up on, which is that people also had trouble with simple active sentences that could not be, at least in a transparent way, could not be accounted for by transformations, by grammatical transformations. And the other thing that was never really looked at is it the case that these two kinds of simple sentences dissociate from each other? And based on what we had been looking at, where you have, you're sort of building a story of this ventral dorsal distinction between, say, manners and paths, between the way verbs are processed, and I didn't talk about prepositions, but it turns out even at single word prepositions, you get what data there is, including some from my lab. It looks like parts of supramarginal gyrus, perhaps angular gyrus, which is, again, going to the parietal cortex, seems to be particularly vulnerable, or prepositions are particularly vulnerable when that part of the brain is damaged. So looking at this, what we did was we gave subjects with brain damage, left hemisphere brain damage, these tasks, and what we do find is that there is a distinction in what parts of the brain are most susceptible or when these parts of the brain are damaged, what kinds of sentences are people most susceptible to making errors. And what we find, again, is a relative dorsal-ventral distinction, which is that when people are making these locative decisions, that it is slightly more dorsal to where when people are making these thematic role making errors in these thematic role judgments. Again, consistent with this as an organizational principle, in this case, using a completely different method, which is patience, and using somewhat of a different task, which is this kind of sentence picture matching task. Okay. So when we're thinking about these actions or things that are happening in space, things that move a certain manner and path and are related, it brings up the general question of information that is changing both in space and time. And this, I put in the slide to remind me of the sense in which you can even have a static image like this and have a sense of the vastness of space and time that are embedded in the kind of information you can get out of that. But what we next did was looked at, rather than this very, very, very long swath of space and time, to the narrowest, the smallest version of something that might have to do with space and time. And this is also a patient study. Elaine Wenzel is the principal author on this, in which we had an experiment where people would look at these images that are either crosses or X's, and they're doing two kinds of judgments. In one, they're judging which is slightly larger, so the notion here is that the object is extended in space, and one is slightly extended more than the other, And then the second task, what they're doing is making a judgment of which of the two, whether it's the X or the cross, appeared first. So they're making a judgment of a temporal order judgment. And the basic idea is that there is a level of granularity of how something is extended in space, and there is a sense of granularity of how two things can occur in time, and what's the threshold for that. And on the right is the behavioral data. So this is a group of patients that have both right brain damage and left brain damage. And what you see in both instances is that the patients themselves don't do as well as elderly controls. That's the top line. But when it comes to this question of size differences, there's not much that separates out the right and the left brain damage people that are somewhat worse. But when you look at this temporal order judgment, it appears that the left brain damage people are somewhat worse than the right brain damage people. So those are the behavioral observations. And some of the mapping observations, what's being done here is saying, in a nutshell, is looking at what the unique variance is in one task versus the other. And the reason for doing that, it is the case that patients in general that are bad in one task tend to be bad on the other task. So overall, there's a correlation in how people do this task. But what we were interested in is what's unique. So there are some people that are a little worse, despite overall being worse on time versus space, and there are patients that are have the converse pattern. And so what we do here is we take the unique variance and try to model that data on their lesion data. And what I'll point out is that for people with right brain damage, that the right parietal cortex seems to be very important for both of these kinds of tasks, although there is a slight difference in the exact location in parietal cortex for them. And this is broadly consistent with Vince Walsh's notion that some of you may know about. He proposed a theory of magnitude estimation where he thought the right parietal cortex was quite important for estimating magnitudes across many different domains. But the second thing is that in the left hemisphere, what we find is that there is unique contributions to damage in the left hemisphere for a time in a way that there isn't for this size estimation. And so this suggests at a first pass that the left hemisphere might have something important to do with time. And again, if you step back from this and think of the last 150 years of clinical neurology and neuropsychology, this doesn't seem so odd because of the big functions that get disrupted when people have left brain damage are language and praxis. And praxis is basically our skill, knowledge of skilled movements. And both of these kinds of abilities, the information that's critical to be competent in these kinds of abilities is sequential information. It's the way information is parsed out in time. And so this idea that maybe the left hemisphere has something important to do with time seems at least plausible. The next experiment, which brings us now to thinking about time a little bit, is an imaging experiment that Elaine Wenzel also did. And we kind of used these sorts of models that people have had in thinking about time, which is that there is a pacemaker, there's some sense of how we accumulate durations. Depending on the kind of task that you have to hold this information in memory, you might have to refer back to some past memories. And then if you have to make a judgment, there is a comparator process. So it's kind of a basic sort of model where there's been some research on trying to understand whether this model caches out within neural systems. And just as an aside, at least in cognitive neuroscience, there's been far, far, far less investigations of time as compared to space. And so we don't know nearly as much about time as we do about space. But the experiment was the cartoon of it is being shown at the bottom right, which is participants are in the scanner. They're looking at a visual stimulus that comes on. It comes on for a certain duration. Then there's a pause. Another visual stimulus comes on, and they just have to say, is the second one longer or shorter than the one previous to it? And the stimulus, the first stimulus, could come on anywhere between 300 and 1500 milliseconds, and the second stimulus would also be with those possible durations. Now, the trick of the experiment in this was that we wanted to be able to model what, by hypothesis, we think is tapping into the accumulator function, which is how long is that first stimulus there, where people have to sort of gauge its duration, and separate out that from the comparator function, which is when they get the second stimulus, they have to decide. They have to make a decision on whether it's longer or shorter. And to do that, basically, we piloted a lot of these pairs of stimuli to end up picking particular pairs where the degree of difficulty of making the judgment was completely orthogonal to the length of the first duration. And by that I mean that if you have two durations that are relatively short that are close to each other and two durations that are relatively long and close to each other, the difficulty would be similar, even though the absolute magnitude of the durations are quite different. And so after piloting the data behaviorally, we felt like we had a pretty good handle on orthogonalizing these two points in the runs so that they could be modeled differently. And what we found was this. If you look at the bottom segments of the brain, that for comparator-related activity, at least in these parts of prefrontal cortex, both on the left and the right, a little more on the left, there was increasing neural activity as the task was harder for people. So we think that this is at least is probably representing neural activity for this comparator function. But in some ways, more interesting is what we found for the accumulator-related activity, which is that there was increased activity tucked in here within the left temporal cortex and also some part of the medial frontal cortex, but particularly this left temporal activation is interesting, and it's interesting because this is very close to where auditory information is processed. Now, there was no sound in this experiment. This is purely a visual experiment, and yet the sense of duration that that people had, by inference, based on the location in the brain, seems to suggest that the auditory system may have something important to do with how we think about time. And it, in some ways, is not so surprising when you think about it. Every time you go to a movie or if you're setting up your sound system with your TV at home, that sound, turns out sound is very promiscuous with respect to spatial locations. So you can have your speakers quite separated from where the sound source is for the image you're looking at, and most people are not all that bothered by it. You know, we will shift where we think a sound is coming from based on visual information. However, we're very, very uncomfortable with temporal distortions in sound, so that if you have someone's mouth moving that's not in line with the sound that's coming, we notice that immediately. So there's a kind of fidelity that sound seems to have with respect to time. So this brought up this a more general question of what is the relationship of time to other kinds of domains, and in the context of this talk, we're interested in spatial representations. And here we turn to the kind of work that Daniel Casasanto has done, where where he and his colleagues have accumulated a lot of information on experiments suggesting that that there is a hierarchy of time and space, and that time largely grafts onto space in a way that that space can contaminate people's judgments of duration, but duration or time does not contaminate people's judgments of distance or space, or at least if it does so, it does in a very asymmetric way. So we wanted to look at this question, and the next set of data are not published. In fact, we're still collecting data on them, but I think they've been interesting enough that it's probably worth presenting. So this is a purely behavioral study, and the question we asked is it the case that those relationships between time and space that that have been described might not hold in the same way if we used auditory information as opposed to visual information, which is how it's traditionally been done. And so these are a series of experiments that Alex Kranyak is doing. And what the setup is, we're looking at duration, distance, and pitch, and looking at combinations of these, and is it the case that one kind of information contaminates judgments of the other kind of information. Now, I can't show you the distance manipulation because this is done with headphones and you have this sort of sense of a sound source moving in space around you, so that was the distance manipulation. But to give you a sense of the duration and pitch manipulations, if this works, you should hear it. So the top two are 1 second and the bottom two are 5 seconds, and the pitch changes slightly, or the pitch changes a lot. So that's what you're going to hear. Could you hear that? Maybe not. Okay, let's try again. Okay, short. Okay, also short, but a much bigger pitch change. And the next two are 5 seconds, and again, I'd like you to sort of get your own intuitions about whether, I'm telling you they're the exact same length of time, but I'd like you to get your own intuitions of whether you experience it that way. So. Okay, so I don't know what your intuitions were, but if you were one of our subjects, this is the kind of data we would get. And what we find is that at least in this setting where the information is being presented in the auditory channel as opposed to visual channel, is that everything contaminates everything else, which is that, and to very similar degrees, which is that if pitch is changing a lot, you think that things are longer, you think that things have moved a greater distance, and you can do each of the possible combinations, everything is in every other thing's business when you give people these kinds of stimuli. Okay, so this at least raises the possibility that there may be modality influences on how space and time are related, and to the extent that we are all somewhat synesthetes of space and time, that the way this is, the weighting of this may have something to do with the kind of modality in which we experience these things. So I'm going to now come to the final part of this this talk, which is ways in which space and time, rather than being thought of as contaminating each other, what are ways in which they work together to give us something that might even be more abstract? And the reason for showing this image is when you look at this, you don't think of the guy at the bottom as sort of lying there taking a nap. You think of him as being forced down there. Right, there's a causal relationship here And again, to use one of Len Tommy's notions, that there are a set of force dynamics here, which he has argued might be a principal semantic domain in and of itself. And so we wanted to look at this, again, in the context of space and time, of how we might start to think about causal structure. And to do this, we used something that can be traced back to David Hume's discussions of causality, where he imagined what would happen if one billiard ball hit another, which really in the 1920s and 30s, Albert Michaud wrote a huge amount about in terms of perceptual causality. And so the basic idea is that this blue ball moves and hits the red ball, and the red ball moves, and in some instances people think the movement of the red ball was caused by the movement of the blue ball, and in some instances they don't. And the kinds of things that most people have talked about that contribute to this perception of causality in the simple event has to do with space and time, which is if things are really are tightly connected in space and tightly connected in time, we apprehend them as causal. So this is an imaging experiment. Benjamin Straub was the principal, was the lead author on this. And what we did was we manipulated both the spatial and a temporal variable parametrically. And I'll show you what that means. So this is the paradigmatic case, which most people experience as causal, right? So the red ball moves immediately after the blue one, and it moves in the same spatial trajectory. And then what we do is we parametrically change both the spatial trajectory and the temporal delay. So this, as you can see, the trajectory shifts again. Here there's a longer spatial delay. I'm sorry, a longer temporal delay is what I meant to say. And here we have both a change in trajectory and a change in the temporal delay. Okay, so that's the basic setup. People are, there are seven different delays, seven different angle deviations, and we have all of them, we have all of them crossed. And so, let me see, yeah, so we have all of them crossed. And here's something we found that we weren't really expecting and was quite puzzling to us, or at least surprising to us, which is that people in general don't use both space and time in making these judgments. That there are space people out there and there are time people out there. And some people use both of them, but they don't use them interactively. At the extremes, they'll use one or the other. Those tend to be the minority of our subjects, and we've actually found this in several behavioral studies. But generally, people either use space or either use time, and it turns out that many more people tend to use time than space in this kind of paradigm. And what's being shown at the top are examples of two individuals where you can see that the person on the left is very sensitive to time, which is that if there are short delays for the second ball moving, this person is much more likely to say it was causal, but it's quite insensitive to these spatial trajectories. And on the right, you see someone with the opposite pattern. Okay, and this is really not something we were expecting when we ran this experiment. Now, when we look at the imaging data, what happens is that if you say, is there a network in the brain that is engaged in causality? So the most obvious thing would be, say, let's take all of the causal trials and subtract them from the non-causal trials, and voila, we should get a causal network. When we do that, we get nothing. There does not seem to be a prototypic causal network in the brain. However, when you look at these behavioral data, it sort of makes sense, which is that people, individuals, are making their judgments, their causal judgments, based on different criteria. And so that when we then model the data not on what's the difference between causal versus non-causal, but whether people are more sensitive to the spatial variables of these events versus the temporal variables of these events, then we get something interesting, which is that what we find is that within the parietal cortex, primarily on the right, that there's increasing neural activity for people as they are more sensitive to the spatial variable, and within the left hemisphere, in parts of the basal ganglia, particularly the putamen, there's more activity for people that are sensitive to the temporal variables. And again, we have another example of what seems as though a different part of the left hemisphere, but again, the left hemisphere being more sensitive to a temporal aspect of these kinds of events. So what we arrive at this is the notion that causality in this very simple model, as perceptual causality in these launching events, as Michaud called it, is probably a compound construct, that it is something that grafts on to these more elemental aspects of space and time. And the last experiment, which Alex did, is trying to look at this in a slightly different way, but now using language. And so this is an fMRI experiment, and people are lying in the scanner, and they're reading these little events, these little three-sentence events. The burger is grilled, the wind gusted, the leaf stirred, the dog barked, so on and so forth. And they see these events in three different contexts, so it's exactly the same, and the order of this is counterbalanced. In one instance, they're making a space judgment, in one a time judgment, in one a causality judgment. And what they're asked to judge is whether when they read the wind gusted, in one instance they have to say, would that as an event have occupied more or less space than the event before that? Or would it have occupied less time, would have been shorter or longer than the one before that, and whether it could have been caused or not caused by the event before that. Okay, so exact same sentences, exact same series of things, but they're really making different kinds of judgments. And what we find here is that if you look at their neural activity when they're making these judgments of space, the spatial characteristics of these events, you get what by now ought to be quite familiar, which is increased activity in parts of posterior parietal cortex, both dorsal and inferior parietal lobules, and you get some activity in parts of the prefrontal cortex, a little bit that looks like it's close to frontal eye fields, but also more ventral to that. But when we look at the activity for their causality judgments as compared to space and time, we get a different pattern. Here we get very frontal polar activity, but we also get parts of middle temporal gyrus, which if you go back to the original or the earlier patient study when people are making judgments of thematic role assignments, which you can think of as a kind of judgment of causal structure, we get activity in a very similar area. Now what's interesting is when you do the contrast of time versus space and causality, we get nothing. Nothing survives that contrast, and so what's going on? Clearly these people are able to think about time. And what we find is that most of the activity for time, if you just look at time subtracted from doing nothing, most of that activity is subsumed within the activity that we see for people making judgments of causality. And so what we would like to infer from this is that even when people are thinking about events in the context of these sentences, so this is not a perceptual task, when they're thinking of events in the context of these kinds of sentences, that there is something about time that is more integrally connected to causality than space, based on the overlap of neural activity. So I think that's sort of the tour of some of the work we've been doing that tries to connect space, time, and causality. And this, here, this is sort of my summary slide, I forgot, which is we do think there's a ventral to dorsal gradient going from objects to spatial relations, and that the same what-where thing cashes out in more dynamic senses with respect to manner and path. There might be, I'm a little cautious about this, but it feels like there might be a right-to-left gradient for how we represent space versus how we represent time. And this question of how space and time are related, in my mind, is still open, whether it's really hierarchical or this is modality and context dependent. And at least in our hands, it looks like causality is more of a compound construct that builds on time and space, but perhaps builds on time more than space. And as promised, this is my consciousness slide, because really this couldn't be done with all of these people, and it really is a group effort for a number of people that have been in the lab over the last several years. Thank you.